In August of 1990, we all heard in the news that Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. The president and his partner said that's not going to stand. And for months, they started buildups. And after the first of the year, the Gulf War started. And I know we all remember watching it on TV as the Air Force dropped strategic laser-guided bombs through doors and windows. Pretty impressive stuff. But the bottom line is we know that wars are fought on the ground. We've been there. We know what it's like. I had the honor this evening of introducing Marines from the 8th Tank Battalion that punched through the lines in the mines, and they're going to tell you their story of success. So it is an honor that I introduce to you the commanding officer of 8th Tank Battalion, Colonel Cavallaro, his S4 officer, Colonel Ahern, and Sergeant Major Adams.
Really, you gotta get on a stage so we can see you.
What do you want to do, stand? I'm here?
Yep.
I want to stand up.
I am standing. I can't talk from an outline. I just can't do this. Especially when I'm facing honorable men and women who served their country so admirably 40 years ago, Vietnam throughout our country's history. It's an honor to be here, and I think it's up Van Appledorn, and I think Sergeant Rear for inviting myself and my crew. Now, listen, I'm no dummy. I went to high school for 15 years. Yeah. When I walked across the state, Dr. Francis, in all his glory, shook my hand. He says, "I got a stipulation." I said, "Well, why?" He says, "I said, what's the stipulation?" He goes, "It's a promise." He says, "You get this diploma, but you can't visit." I said, "You got a deal. I'm out of here." And the rest is history. What it is I'm not a dummy because I got two guys here behind me who, along with 1,017 other Marines and 17 sailors, made me look good 31 years ago. 31 years ago, it's been a fable. It's a rock and roll fable. It's a wartime fable. We were not supposed to do what we did over there. And what we did was epic. Where's that first slide of the of where we are from? We have four states. Yeah, I know where I'm from. But the guys that came with me were from four different states. Columbia, South Carolina, Tallahassee, Florida, Miami, Florida, Syracuse, New York, Rochester, New York. It was amazing. 1989, General Boomer, who was the 4th Bombardier Division Commander, 4th Bombardier Commander, called me to New Orleans. He and I got along real good. We compared, his son was as old as my son, and they were both hoodlums. They were. They were both street fighters, and they would get a lot of problems. But we took care of notes. We had a ball. Benny told me, he says, Mike, you assume the command in your mind. I went to your ATD, which is active duty for training, for those of you that don't know, because we were reservists. I went to the Marine Corps, I got drafted, and then I got ripped after Vietnam. I joined the 24 hours after I got released from active duty, I joined the reserves because I had to be a part of them. Even though I didn't know they existed when I got hurt, I fell in love with it. So he says, "I want you to concentrate on doing severe ATVs, We've taken two companies and one private tow for picking. The rest of them will go to Cass. No liberty, no nothing. I went a month full of Cassatree and I'm moving to contact, occupying defensive positions. He said, well, tanks, we're tankers. Use the supporting arms and grunts. You're going to integrate grunts with everything you do. So you'll tag, you have attached infantry along with the tanks. And we did that, not knowing what was over the horizon. 1980 and 1990, 1,017 Marines, as I said, and 17 sailors were activated. And throughout the Eastern Seaboard, every tank company had those Marines report to their drill centers. 98% of this battalion reported within 24 hours. That's amazing. Despite the dire predictions of the journalists and the people that were running the papers and TVs, we were all supposed to die in place. There's no, and yet, these kids, 19 kids and guys, the older fellows, they reported on as they're supposed to. They came from colleges, dorm rooms. They came from welders and Chrysler, Ford, GM. They were teachers. I had cops. Yeah, John can tell you, he's a state trooper. He also had one who was an inmate. Yeah. But that's okay. We came together and we reported to our drill centers. And then we went to what was called the SIA, which was the Station of Initial Assignment, which was Camp North Carolina, wherever Marine goes anyway. So we huddled there, we got there through buses, we went from Rochester, the HS company, and the battalion staff were located from Rochester, New York, with the detachment of HS people from all the other companies we had. We had Alpha Company from Fort Knox, Kentucky. We had Bravo Company from Syracuse, New York. We had Charlie Company from Columbia, South Carolina. We had Delta Company from Tallahassee, Florida. Plus we had an AT tank missile company from Miami, Florida. They all came. They all reported. And we all settled in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. And we went through all kinds of training. These things hate this stuff. Anyway, smack it up as you go, Colonel. No, like I said, we occupied defensive positions, integration. I had a three who he was an active duty three. He was an INI staff. I got a master gunnery sergeant, Hobart, who took him. And I got Major Jeff Texas, who was the assistant INI of Rochester. I knew this kid was shit hot as a tanker and as a planner, and I needed him. So I took him on board Joe. So all that at the Camp Lejeune went all through this training, MPC training, pistol requalifications, rifle qualifications, foresight and zeroing, the whole nine yards. Plus, we sent Ford Air Controllers to Yuma, Arizona for advanced training there. And we also sent an advanced party overseas to start looking at MPF shipping. Because that's where we're going to take your guys' tanks off the ships. It was started in the Reagan administration in 1980. These MPF ships, ships had F-60 Alpha 1s on board those ships. The only thing, these were Vietnam-era tanks. You guys' tanks. The only thing upgrade was the sights in 1980. Otherwise, they were Vietnam-era tanks. Then we got them off the ships, and they were supposed to be LPI. Forget about it. They were not. No one touched those babies for at least a year. We couldn't run those hogs a mile without dropping and stopping because fuel filters were being clogged up with sand. You couldn't get nowhere over it. So, this guy here, along with my Gunner Thompson and Warrant Officer LH, said, listen, Colonel, we got a shot here. We get these M60s out. We'll change the fuel filters on them, and we'll run JP1 on them. Let's check fuel. They said, we won't get it anywhere. They did it. Then he says, we're going to paint them. That's a camo, because they were green. And so we got them painted. Then we said to at that time, I think we showed General Keyes said to me, hey, he says, hey, Mike, he says, you're going to be the tip of the spear. I said, oh, really? That's freaking great, General. I don't know whether to cry or laugh. Listen to this. The TE of that second MAR div, which we were attached to, also contained the U.S. Army Tiger Brigade. They had 320 tanks in one brigade. That was more tanks than the Marine Corps had, and had the duty or reserve combined. Plus, they had the second tank battalion attached. I'm saying to myself, I think they got a plan for us. It ain't good. And I had some good people behind me. One was Dennis Morgan, my XO, that's the way. Very early on after we left, he came back. I'm sure this was awful. The bottom line is, he said, Mike, they want us to die in place and they want to save us. I said, that can't be true, not in my mind. Well, whatever it was or not, but that's what happened. I mean, that was the TE. It makes you think, it makes you wonder. Like I said, I'm no dummy. So, I turned, we looked at what we have at Camp Lejeune. We do what we're supposed to do, and we fly over to and we get our tanks out, and we go into the desert, and we start training. Poor Dennis pulled up my axle. He goes, I can't stand it. I have to go to every meeting. You're always with the troops. I said, so? He says, I said, that's what you're going to do. He said, I can't stand it. Get out of here. No. I said, just go to the meetings. I'll stay with the troops. But you know what? I had the opportunity to do it, and that's what I did. So anyway, we're in this desert environment. We're training. We're bore sight and zeroing. We're doing offensive operations, defensive operations. Now you guys, you performed your tank stuff in Vietnam in a completely different way. We were wide open. We had attached infantry, we had on-call air, on-call supporting arms, but I did not know also that we were supposed to reach two minefields for the fellow armed forces, the second MAR did. That was a surprise. And again, I'm no dummy. Okay? I turned to this guy right here in my OIC in my breech. This is the same guy that General Schwarzkopf lauded. He said he had never seen a thing like this. You know what? We didn't either. But that's okay. That's okay. That's the way it was supposed to be. So we go and we train up. And we get these Marines and these sailors up to snuff, ready to go to battle with the Iraqi army. And they were huge. They had over 2,100 tanks in Kuwait alone. We were facing thousands of tanks between the crossing of the line of departure, which is Al-Kabir, right? And then going to southern Kuwait. And we had thousands of tanks in front of us. We were surrounded. Plus, we had two minefields to dig up. There was this warrant officer from the Army. He was in, I think he was in when Joshua Pease was on board as a Lance Corporal. He was a warrant officer 5. You don't see that anywhere. This guy was had more years than anybody. You looked at Warren Officer Thompson and Colonel Aaron. He said, we have some farm equipment for you guys. He says, for your breaching operations. Advanced plows, whatever. And until a year ago, they were top secret. We got them from the nation of Israel. To this day, they're amazing people, amazing soldiers, and they came to our defense. And he says, you're never going to get these things welded on. You got 72 hours before you got the belt drops. No, 4 days. He says, don't worry about it. Better times, he says, I got people from the welders from GM, Chrysler, Ford. I got them all over the place. I got things. These guys are reservists. And they got jobs to go back to. They can't screw around in this desert. They're going to get it done. And you know what they did? They attached all those farm equipment. And I'm not stealing the thunder, but because they're going to talk about it too. But they cleared 2 minefields, a mile wide each and a mile deep. And when they did this, we also had combat trained, logistic trains following and traced, first time ever. We also had a medical train following and traced to provide medical assistance to those that were beat up in the minefield. We lost a lot, we did have some mobility chills in the minefield. We lost some tanks. But we got these guys out, we pulled the tanks out, but they only M88 Retriever in country. We owned it. We owned it. And we got them out, and we got them back 24 hours later, welded the whole 9 years back in the plate again. The things that these guys and gals did, and these young Marines did, it was amazing. It never ceases to, that's what I'm saying. I'm not here to bamboozle or anything. I'm not that kind of guy. I'm not smart enough. All I know is what we did there 31 years ago was a wartime fable. Jesus was on our side, and believe me, there is no atheist in the foxhole. I guarantee it to you. I've seen it happen. I've seen transformations of big tough guys on their knees. Saying to them, I need one more day. Give me one more day. And amen to that. Because I'll tell you, we were blessed. We should not have done what we did 31 years ago. Because it just wasn't in the cards. But apparently it was. And he did it for us. To this day, I just am amazed at what we did and how we did it, and we did it so professionally. I'm going to turn it over. This is Colonel John A. He's my own.
First off, let me tell you, when I start running this presentation here, the first few slides are specific to you guys in Vietnam. And I understand that there's somebody in here that owns one of these tanks, or was the owner of it at one time. And 48s. I started out 48s, went to 60s, and then the M1A1s. What the colonel's trying to tell us here is his job was with bringing people from all over the United States in 72 hours. The logistical miracle that these young Marines pulled off. And then when he got them overseas, what they did for them. I was a doctoral student at the time. And the semester was ending. I had been a commanding officer of Bravo Company. And actually, I slipped over to McCursick job at Marine Corps Reserve Support Command out in Kansas City while I was in school. They just couldn't grill them. And uh, uh, I left school and showed up and he hired me. So that's how I got.
One good thing after another.
So anyway, the slides I'm gonna have in here, they're in random order, okay? Set it up just to run randomly, 20 seconds on each slide, we'll be done, okay? So let me get that started. And one of the things, I'm just gonna start here, that's how the mileage from Camp Lejeune to Saudi Arabia. One of the things that that we did was, I wanna wait till I get to your slides. So, 20 cents. Okay, so when you guys fought in Vietnam, for the most part, except a couple of different instances, you fought usually two tanks per section, and that's the way you went out and supported. From most of the research that I did, that's the way you supported. Okay. How many Desert Storm veterans are in here?
Okay. Not a tanker.
Nope. But what? There's your who owns that one?
They got one.
There you go. That's yours.
That's my tank.
That's your tank.
That's my tank.
Okay. So what you guys did, you went out, you fought with, I mean, the grunts walking right with you, you were ahead of them, they were behind, whatever. What the Marine Corps did after that, it saw that we can't continue to fight this way with armor, because the Army's going to take our job. So what they did is they learned to fight in a maneuver warfare battalion size. So Marine Corps at that time had four battalions, or five battalions. Tanks, and we deployed four of those battalions, and a company out of another one. And it was an F out of four tanks, it was an M1A1. And the thing I want to remind you is that you guys set the standard of how a two-man tank section worked. The Marine Corps spent millions and millions and millions of dollars to train people to fight as a battalion, company battalions. Then we get to Iraq, and we're right back to deploying platoons who sent out two-man sections after the march up. And we went up with four times. After the fight, the insurgency, we sent two tanks at a time. Got to Afghanistan, two tanks at a time. And I was there for both of them. I can tell you, I planned them on a couple of things. And I was absolutely in shock. No, we got to run it. No, we can't. We're too channelized, we're going to lose things. So what you guys did, the Marine Corps came, 15 years later, came full cycle. Right back to two-man sections. So okay, so I'm going to start this as just a random. Like the colonel said, everybody came from college, from work. They got to Camp Lejeune, and the MPF system that the colonel was talking about is maritime pre-position stuff. It was out in the Pacific Ocean. And we had war stocks up in Norway, and we had the maritime pre-position stuff down in Florida. Popped it out, they sent it over to Saudi Arabia. Third Tanks was already there, they've been there since August. Their stuff was wearing out. Our stuff got there off MPF, and then they were taking stuff from our companies and putting it on ship, following ship. Brought it over. I was there at the port when we were taking these tanks off with one officer, L. Hayes, etc. And as we were taking them off, the logistical thing here was just an absolute nightmare. You got these tanks off. First off, they didn't start because they'd been on ship for a year. Nobody bothered to start. Then you get them off, say, okay, we slave them, get them off. And so okay, you gotta get them in, you gotta get them LTI, get things going. Pop the sponsor boxes, not a tool set one. Somebody in the MPF has got a business someplace. It's not a tool set one for 53 tanks.
That's cool.
That's all, it's civilian shipping. So it's got them. So if we pull all the rolling stock off, the railroads that went over, we sent Marines on board ships. They were supposed to get all the stuff ready to go, so Van Cruz wouldn't let them touch it. So for 8 days, they floated, slept. as a good Marine will do. He's got the opportunity. So, and, you know, anyway, I'm not gonna belabor that, but when we put together the breach force, and that's the only thing I can really speak to, because that's what the colonel had been doing. Colonel tells me I'm going to be the OIC of breach force, and I couldn't spell breach. So, and then he told me I was going to go into minefields. I said, we don't do that stuff, you know. However, we ended up doing it. As he said, I want to back him up. The Israeli aircraft industry sent contractors making huge money. These contractors they didn't come with any tools. They came to us and said, we're going to teach you how to put these mine plows, mine rakes, all kind of different stuff on these tanks. And it took them 9 hours to do one tank. 9 hours to put this. You got to tie it into the driver system, electronics. You got to be tied in. And you got to make it so that you can still seal the hatch and stuff like this. So anyway, Randy Jessup was a staff sergeant in the H&S company. He was watching them do this stuff. And as he's watching them do it, he says, I can beat that. He says, we can do this differently. And 10 minutes, got it, okay. So he said, he pushed the contractor aside, and he grabs a bunch of Marines, and takes him 5 hours to do the next one. Well, then they're doing some more. And I'm saying, man, we're not going to be ready to train with these. We're not going to be ready to cross the other. I know the date, you know, or the time frame. We're not going to be able to do this. He got my 28 tanks. He got them outfitted down to an hour and 30 minutes per tank. That's up. And then we trained them. But our Marines from the breach force were a conglomeration of Marines from 2nd Tank Battalion, 8th Tank Battalion, but cursing tankers that had gotten out, and they were within their 2-year contract. And when you sign for 4 years, you had to stay 6. Well, these guys got pulled back in. They came over as replacements. And I remember getting all these guys together. We had one captain, one gunnery sergeant, a sergeant, Michael Brown, and we got out of jail.
Yeah. Where you find the best Marines.
And by the way, when he came back, they allowed him to, he was intoxicated, entered somebody's garage and fell asleep and charged him with burglary. When he came back, they gave him, he pled guilty to trespass time served. So he made up. He ended up retiring as a gun sergeant. Pretty damn possible. Shit out of money. But I sat with all these Marines, and I said, this is what our job is going to be. And I remember this kid from 2nd Tanks, he stood up, and he said, yeah, that's kind of bullshit. He says, aren't you Reserve Marines? And I said, yes, we are. And he said, well, aren't we going to be back in reserve? That's why I volunteered. But anyway, tip of the spear going over. So we ended up going across the berm. Nobody could see. It was dark, dark, dark. You're gonna see some stuff. And I put a faraway looks on these on the communicators inside the C-7. You know. And these kids, they came together. They worked well. Go through the breach. I'm going through the breach, and I hear a radio conversation between the company commander and Bravo. I got to give the Sergeant Major here some time here, so I got to get going. Because you did with all that stuff you did with getting me people. I hear this conversation between the Master Gunnery Sergeant, tank leader, and the company commander. The Master Gunnery Sergeant wants to get back with his company, but he's in rolling stock, and he's not going to go where the tanks are going. And he's begging him to let me cross over into your lane so I can come over there and travel with you, because I don't want to lose my company. Well, there was mortars coming in, and he's screaming about, you know, I'm taking, he's in a Humvee, soft side to dump it. I'm taking fire here, all this crap going on, and we're trying to get through the breach. We're trying to push gun companies now through the breach so that they can come out of the other end and lead the division. And so he said, it's the strangest communication I've ever heard on a radio. The company commander for Bravo Company, Jim Evans, says to Top, he says, Master Guns, he says, did I understand you're taking fire? He says, yeah. He says, well, if it gets too intense, zip up your window. It's a plastic window. And you never heard another Master Guns said, just shut up, never heard another word. So, but anyway, came through, we lost four tanks in the breach, and I lost my AEA. I had a Korean War tanker running my AEA, and he came. He was 60 years old, he was hiding from the division because they tried to send him back. He turned 60, he couldn't get around.
That's what Marines do.
Yep. So he came out with me, and Gunner Jake.
Yep.
And he came out, and I'm screaming at him on the radio when tank hit a mine, with plow and stuff. And let me tell you something, 13,000 pounds per blade on a plow. And it, when I watched that thing, it picked 13,000 pounds up on that anti-tank mine and bent it right back to the cupola and then dropped it on the ground, and I thought another thing blew up. That's how powerful those things were. That, okay, so I'm going to give the... So anyway, we come out the other end, we lose this. Gunner Jay comes screaming out with the only 88 I had. For those of you that don't know, it's a retriever. For some of the ladies that may not know this. And the CWO4 comes out. He wasn't 40 yards into that minefield, and he blows up the only 88 we had. So I had nothing to pull these guys out. These guys sat in the minefield for days afterwards. AT mines in there, AP mines in there. They can't get off the tanks. So it was just that's the only portion of this that I can remember. Because when I got out the other end, he went into a defensive position. I climbed on top of a Mark 110 radio jeep, fell asleep with my mop suit on. Slept for 9 hours. I don't remember a thing. For 9 hours, I don't remember anything. People went into the minefield, vehicles went into the minefield, blew up probably 75 yards. Never heard. So anyway, Sergeant Major, I got to turn it over to you because there's very little time left.
What time do we have?
3 minutes.
We have 2 minutes.
You can make that six if you want.
Okay, everybody, thank you. It's an honor to be here. Thank you very much. So I didn't have a hero status. I was the admin chief to make sure that everybody was paid and taken care of. One of the things that I hear about every day is that the families were either being evicted out of their homes or evicted out of apartments because our Marines were not getting paid. At that time, the Department of Defense was transitioning from mainframe systems to desktop computers and network servers. Those two systems, they never developed a gateway to transfer information. So when the 4th Marine Division, the 8th Tank Battalion, transferred to 2nd Marine Division, the 4th Tank Battalion literally was vaporized. So inside of 30 days, we had to reconstruct with our SRBs 1,017 Marines with the 8th Tank Battalion in the 2nd Marine Division. So I'm going to jump forward. We were right before D-Day. I was traveling through the desert with my driver. I was a gunnery sergeant at the time. They wouldn't let me drive, which was a good thing. And I'm driving through the desert, and all of a sudden I find these three white trucks and all these big white tanks. And I tell the driver, I said, white tents. And I said, take me over there. And it's a gentleman from AT&T. They're putting up satellite dishes. white trucks. And I asked, I said, who's the supervisor in here? I said, can I talk to him? And he comes over, and I said, can I have a conversation with you? And I rolled out the map. I said, you are located here? And he goes, yeah. He goes, yeah, we're right here. I said, you want to know where the bad guys are? I go, they're right here. He goes, really? And I said, yes, they are. And I said, I love your trucks, by the way. Needless to say, inside of a couple hours, they had the tents up, they had the generators running. We had tents full of phones, we could pick up the phone, and we were talking to Americans. It was great. So what we did was, is I took my Marines in the middle of the night, we actually had to steal vehicles. We stole vehicles, we stole buses, and I would put my Marines, I had 36 Marines in my section, and we would take the SRVs, and we'd take off at 2 o'clock in the morning, we'd go to this site, and we would pick up the phone, and we would call Kansas City, and by Social Security number, we got all our Marines paid. And we were the only unit that transferred from the 4th Marine Division to receive pay. It was great. And there's all the efforts. And I think it's great.
We're saving one more minute. It's not really good. It's going to be about 2 or 3.
Turn faster.
I can't do it. The milestones. I got to say this because, in spite of me, they did miraculous things. We were the first unit. Elements of the 18th Battalion were the first units to lead an active duty Marine division who had an Army brigade plus their own tank battalion attached to them through two months. That's never going to happen before. Never. Okay. Then we were the first ones in the minefield elements of the 18th Battalion. A guy, this young captain came up to me and was hitting on my C-7 and we got him through the escape hatch because we were getting hit. He goes, "I know where you are." I said, "No shit, I know where I am." I said, "I'm getting the shit knocked out of me. What's wrong with you, young captain?" He says, "No, I got you within 10 meters. Flyers. We were the first ones hooked up, which is a precursor to SATCOM and now GPS. We were the first ones to be locked on the bars. So they had them, see, I told you, Jesus is watching over us, up there. But then we can go on and on, but the bottom line is that we had a lot of firsts, and we took care of business despite the fact that we were reservists. And as a result of being reservists, I think it was a huge offensive, things that went better because we were reservists, because we didn't stop at saying, "Oh, we can't do this." We did it and it worked. Sergeant Major Adams, Colonel Ahern, and myself want to thank Top Plan Eppelhorn again and Sergeant John Beer for inviting us to the Vietnam Tankers Association reunion. We are as proud of our Marines as I am proud of you to be a part of this honorable people here. It's just, I can't tell you what we are.
Paved the way for us.
Thank you.
Hoorah!
This is both bittersweet and ironic because recent events of the Marine Corps and the decision-making process is now taking our tanks away from us. Bittersweet in the fact that you guys and us guys fought with the last Vietnam tanks ever in the major battlefield. Ironic in that reservists, the ones that did it. And this is amazing. And I hope from the bottom of my heart, you tankers from Vietnam, I hope we did you proud. Thank you.
Just to what the Colonel said, when I returned as the Acting Sergeant Major of Terror Combat Engineers, I was ordered back to headquarters of Marine Corps to report to the Commandant's conference room. When I got there was a two-star general named Bill Groniger, a captain on active duty, a couple staff sergeants, and a bunch of O-1s. And when the Commandant came in, it was Kelly, and he sat us down and he said, "We don't have enough regulars and we smell smoke in the wind." Now this is 1986. And I said, "Sir, can you be a little more definitive on what you mean by smoke in the wind?" He says, "I can't, First Sergeant, but here's what you're charged with. Hopefully, within no longer than 7 months, you can call every swinging dick reserve on active duty. And they're not coming on active duty for a PX call. They're going to spend 4 days on the rifle range. They're going to do land nav. They're going to do survival. They're going to do NBC training. They're going to work in their MOS for a couple of days, and then you're going to send them back, and they're going to be in a standby status. We trained pretty close to about 75,000 reserves in that 7 months. We fortunately had a few guys in federal prison and about four that had passed away and their wives were still collecting checks. But other than that, those reserves trained and they trained hard. And thank God we have them, because we did not have enough regular Marines when Kuwait broke out. We needed every swinging reserve to be there. So Colonel, to you and your troops, thank you. God bless you. General Pike. All right, let's take a break. We got to switch the computer over for...